Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Francis Alonso reporting. Burundi's president is scheduled to deliver a nationwide address Tuesday amid increasing pressure for him to abandon plans to run for a third term. According to his office, President Pierre Nkurunziza will speak on radio and television at 8 p.m. local time. Protests against the president resumed in the capital Tuesday, with demonstrators vowing to continue until the president withdraws his plan to seek re-election. The president withstood a coup attempt last week when he was out of the country for a regional conference focused on Burundi's political situation. On Monday, a summit of the African Great Lakes region countries called on Burundi to postpone the June 26th election until the country is stabilized. A court in Kabul has sentenced 11 police officers, including a district police chief, to one-year jail terms on Tuesday while setting eight others free over the mob beating of a woman in Kabul earlier this year. This is the court proceedings that we hear here. The judge found the 11 officers guilty of neglecting their duty to protect 27-year-old Fakunda from the brutal March 19th attack that was sparked by false accusations that she had desecrated the Quran. Cell phone video showed people beating her with sticks, pushing her body from a rooftop, and running it over with a car, among other atrocities. A huge Paris-based bank, BNP Paribas, has forfeited some $8.8 billion to the U.S. Justice Department after it was convicted of handling funds in violation of U.S. sanctions against Iran, Cuba, and Sudan. Now the Justice Department is considering whether to use part of that compensation to compensate people harmed by the government's VOA News. Shiite militias massed Tuesday outside the Iraqi city of Ramadi ahead of a possible offensive to try to recapture the Anbar provincial capital from Islamic State militants. Iraq's defense ministry, meanwhile, released a video showing the rescue of 28 soldiers after the Islamic State group seized Ramadi in several days of fighting that sent Iraqi troops fleeing and prompting Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi to call for militia help. The United Nations is intensifying pressure on Southeast Asian governments that have been reluctant to come to the rescue of refugees and migrants stranded at sea following a crackdown on human traffickers. A joint statement Tuesday by a coalition of UN agencies directly appealed to the leaders of Indonesia, Malaysia, and Thailand to reverse their policies of pushing back the boats full of desperate refugees. During his visit to South Korea Monday, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry indicated that China is considering supporting new sanctions against North Korea. However, analysts tell VOA's Brian Padden in Seoul that they are skeptical that Beijing will take any punitive measures that might cause instability on the Korean Peninsula.
I want to announce that.
Meanwhile, the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says he is planning to visit a factory park that lies just north of the demilitarized zone that separates North and South Korea. Ban Ki-moon's planned tour of the jointly run Kaesong Industrial Complex would mark the first time in more than two decades that a UN Secretary General had visited North Korea. Mr. Ban is expected to meet with North Korean workers and South Korean businessmen during that trip to Kaesong.
The U.S. Secretary of State harshly criticized Pyongyang for its continued pursuit of nuclear weapons and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un personally for allegedly executing a number of high-ranking officials, including Defense Minister Hyung Yong-chol, with an anti-aircraft gun. North Korea and China analyst John Delory with Yonsei University in Seoul says it is likely that Beijing's leaders share Mr. Kerry's concerns, but he doubts they support increasing pressure on the regime.
It makes me skeptical when we hear American officials speaking on behalf of Beijing.
Brian Padden, VOA News, Seoul.
The U.S. State Department has proposed releasing private emails from U.S. presidential candidate Hillary Clinton in early 2016. The State Department made that proposal late on Monday in response to a lawsuit filed under the Freedom of Information Act. I'm Francis Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
This is a first point of entry for refugees coming from Burundi, about 500 meters from the border. It is actually a little fishing village that has been now inundated with about 50,000 people.
That's Caroline Blaney, Regional Humanitarian Advisor for the International Rescue Committee. Details coming up.
Also, the European Union approves a naval operation to pursue human traffickers on the Mediterranean and stem the increasing flow of migrants from Africa and the Middle East.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Malawi, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Burundi's president is scheduled to deliver a nationwide address today amid increasing pressure for him to abandon plans to run for a third term. According to his office, President Pierre Nkurunziza will speak on radio and television at 8 p.m. local time. Protest against the president resumed in the capital today, with demonstrators vowing to continue until the president withdraws his plan to seek re-election. The president withstood a coup attempt last week when he was out of the country for a regional conference focused on Burundi's political situation. Yesterday, a summit of African Great Lakes region countries called on Burundi to postpone the June 26 election until the country is stabilized.
Well over 100,000 people have fled Burundi in recent weeks to escape political violence. They have been crossing into Tanzania, Rwanda, and the DRC. In Tanzania, the first stop for the refugees is the northern fishing village of Kagunga. It is now very crowded as people wait for boats to take them to their next destination in Tanzania. Caroline Blaney is the regional humanitarian advisor for the International Rescue Committee from Kigoma. She spoke to VOA's Jody Kapua about refugees in Kagunga.
This is a first point of entry for refugees coming from Burundi, about 500 meters from the border. It is actually a little fishing village that has been now inundated with about 50,000 people. So when you come up onto the shore, you see almost about, I would guess, 3 kilometers long of people lined up and stacked in. Very tight conditions. People are living literally dwelling to dwelling. The latrines are well within the site of the housing. You have limited water. People are bathing and drinking from the lake itself. It's very hectic, and people have very few things.
Now, I understand they have to wait for a 100-year-old boat to try to make a trip to their next location. I spoke with UNHCR yesterday. A spokesperson said they had added a second boat. Can you give us an idea of what this boat trip is like?
Sure. So the boat is a 100-year-old boat. It's a German boat that's been here since 1915. When refugees are taken by smaller fishing dinghies to the boat itself from the shore, then they are transported back. The conditions on the boat itself are reasonable, and we're able to deliver medical services while on the boat making the trip. And WFP is distributing some food. It's about a 3-hour trip, and the second boat that's come has a capacity of 300 people. So the first boat, the original boat, has a capacity of about 700 people. So that was the only amount that could be ferried twice a day. Every 24 hours was 1,400 people. So now with the second boat, we have an additional 300 people being transported, so 2,000 people every 24 hours. It's a major issue also in terms of the elderly and the sick. Getting them onto the boat itself is an issue where you have these little fishing dinghies. You have to load people on the shore into those and then from the fishing dinghies onto the boat. So it's not ideal, especially when you're loading patients who need to be evacuated.
What is the next stop from Kagunga?
The next stop from Kagunga is to Kigoma. Kigoma, the city, along with the government and the UNHCR, have identified the stadium of the city as the official transit center. And this is where refugees are registered formally. We do protection screening, health screening, And they, from there, might spend the night, have some wet feeding, be provided a meal, and then from there go by bus to the camp in Nyarugusu.
So this is a rather involved trip. How long do you think it will take to get all those refugees in Kagunga to their final destination?
It's a major logistical challenge. If we have 50,000 people and can only move up to 2,000 at a time, you can do the math. We are planning for about 8 months of emergency response in both Kagunga and then in Kigoma. So we anticipate it may take up to 8 months to move everyone. And the main thing, too, to know is that getting supplies into Kagunga was also a major challenge, again, because you only have this one form of transportation. So what agencies have done is we started to rent speedboats, which can take staff in and out and also supplies in and out on a more regular basis so that we can ameliorate the conditions within Kagunga as we wait to move people.
What other services is the International Rescue Committee providing?
In Kagunga itself, we have been providing since the 29th of last month primary health care. And what we are doing essentially is treating cases of acute watery diarrhea, also burns because they're cooking so closely to where they're living. So we see quite a few burn victims. And then also working to get water tanks in to the site in order to provide safe drinking water. And also we're doing screening for unaccompanied minors and also sexual or gender-based violence. It's important to note that the majority of these refugees are women and children and under five, and that they do have very specific needs that do need to be met. Otherwise, the situation will massively deteriorate.
Caroline Blaney is the Regional Humanitarian Advisor for the International Rescue Committee from Kigoma. She spoke to VOA's Jody Kapua.
South Sudanese rebels have reportedly captured the site of an oil refinery near the country's main oil fields. Hilary Hewler has more from our East Africa Bureau in Nairobi.
A spokesman for rebels loyal to South Sudan's former vice president, Riek Machar, say rebel forces have captured an oil refinery in Upper Nile State. The refinery is near one of the country's largest working oil fields, Paloch. James Dock said in a statement they had done so in order to deprive the government of oil revenues used to fight the country's ongoing civil war. UN mission to South Sudan spokesperson Ariane Cantier says she was aware of Dock's claims but could not confirm them. An analyst at the Juba-based Sud Institute, Jok Madok-Jok, says none of the refineries in South Sudan are operational, but the move could still affect the war by frightening foreign oil companies.
There will have repercussions for the confidence of the oil companies operating there in terms of whether they should continue to produce or should withdraw their staff. Because the closer the rebels get to the production fields, the more likely that the oil companies will say we have to halt production and take our people out of harm's way.
Doc also said the rebels had asked foreign oil companies to remove their staff and close the fields to avoid damaging them. Despite several ceasefire agreements, South Sudan has experienced a surge in violence in recent weeks. Rebel forces launched an assault Friday in Malakal, and the East African bloc IGAD, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, says government troops have been targeting civilians and committing human rights abuses. The UN Children's Fund says children in particular are being targeted. With the government entirely dependent on oil revenue from the few oil fields still operating, any fighting nearby is a high-stakes game, says Jock.
If the rebels take control of the actual productive oil fields, then they could probably bring the war to a close very quickly. There's no any other source of input for the government.
Last week, the United Nations and international aid groups evacuated their humanitarian staff from Unity State, next to Upper Nile, leaving hundreds of thousands in need of food and medical services. Hilary Hewler for VOA News, Nairobi.
The European Union has approved a naval operation to pursue human traffickers on the Mediterranean and stem the increasing flow of migrants from Africa and the Middle East. EU foreign policy chief Federica Mogherini says the seizure of vessels may start in June. France, Britain, Italy and other nations have pledged naval vessels. The EU fleet is expected to begin chasing and boarding rafts and fishing boats suspected of carrying migrants. The EU has requested UN Security Council action that would offer them legal protection to stop, seize and possibly destroy the boats. Member states are resisting at a separate proposal that establishes resettlement quotas for each of the 28 EU members. The EU Commission hopes to reduce the number of migrants entering Europe this summer and find homes for most of those who arrived in past months. The International Office for Migration says almost 40,000 have arrived by sea in the last 5 months, most on Italian shores. At least 1,800 migrants have drowned trying to reach European shores this year.
Minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon warns the conflict in Yemen could lead to a destabilization of East Africa. Mr. Ban has given the Security Council a new report on Somalia. He says the continuing conflict there offers an entry point for jihadists from Yemen. Ban is calling for more international financial support for the Somali National Army and a joint military force of the AU. The Security Council has already discussed the possibility of taking over peacekeeping duties in Somalia. Ban also urges donors to fund his $863 million appeal to help nearly 3 million Somalis facing humanitarian needs.
Past the hour. You were listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The International Labour Organization warns a decrease in traditional forms of labour is leading to increased poverty because of widespread insecurity in the global jobs market. In this year's World Employment and Social Outlook 2015 report, the ILO examines the changing nature of jobs. Lisa Schlein reports from the launch of the report at ILO headquarters in Geneva.
The so-called company man who could rely on a steady job, salary, and a pension at the end of his work life is an endangered species. New data shows fewer than one in four workers today is employed in this stable, traditional form of labor. The International Labor Organization's report analyzed employment trends in countries covering 84% of the global workforce. It finds three-quarters of workers are employed on temporary or short-term contracts in informal jobs or in unpaid family jobs. ILO Director General Guy Ryder says more than 60% of all workers, most of them in the developing world, lack any kind of employment contract. He adds, even among those workers who have a wage and salary, less than half have permanent work contracts.
One consequence of this type of transformation in the employment relationship is that it is contributing to the growing divergence between labour incomes and productivity, with productivity growing faster than wages in much of the world, which we think has been an important factor in the current employment crisis. And our report estimates that the loss in global demand as a consequence of employment trends coming from the crisis, stands at $3.7 trillion US dollars.
Latest ILO estimates put the number of unemployed workers globally at 201 million, 30 million more than before the 2008 global economic crisis struck. Ryder says the shift from the traditional employment relationship to non-permanent forms of employment is leading to growing unemployment and a rise in inequality and poverty rates in many countries.
Temporary and informal workers, part-timers, unpaid family workers, many of them women, are disproportionately affected by poverty and by social exclusion. And by and large, the non-standard forms of employment go with lower pay and lesser coverage of social protection.
Ryder adds, data from a majority of countries find part-time jobs outpace gains in full-time work between 2009 and 2013. The report says the number of wage and salary jobs continues to grow worldwide, but with wide variations across regions. For example, it says in the developed economies and in Central and Southeastern Europe, around 8 in 10 workers are employees. On the other hand, it says that figure is closer to 2 in 10 in South Asia and in Sub-Saharan Africa. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The U.S. Agency for International Development has launched a competition to find innovative science and technology solutions to combat illegal wildlife trafficking. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from Bangkok.
USAID is offering a grand prize of up to $500,000 for innovations from the public to stem the slaughter of wildlife. Applications have to address at least one of four issues for which innovative science and technology solutions can offer immediate impact. USAID Mission Director in Asia Michael Yates says the four areas of concern are detection of transit routes, strengthening forensic evidence, reducing consumer demand, and tackling corruption.
They're all interlinked, and it's going to take concerted action in each one of these areas to really address this issue, and something that needs to be addressed with urgency. The trend lines are just enormously troublesome with respect to the increase in poaching.
Achieving solutions, Yates says, has to involve everyone in society.
It's not the kind of issue governments will be able to solve on their own, and we look forward to receiving applications from a broad range of creative people to help us better understand how we can, working together, more effectively address each one of these aspects of illegal wildlife trade.
Interested individuals or organizations have until June 30th to submit a short concept note describing their solution to enter the Wildlife Crime Tech Challenge. The USAID initiative includes partnerships with National Geographic, the Smithsonian Institution, and the Wildlife Trade Monitoring Network, TRAFFIC. USAID says judges will evaluate applications based on impact and scalability. Those deemed to have the most promising concept notes will move forward in the competition. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Ebola cases are continuing their downward trend in Sierra Leone. Religious leaders have contributed to the progress by helping to educate people in their churches and mosques. Nina De Vries reports from Freetown.
Sierra Leone is a religious country, but what makes it somewhat unique is the religious tolerance. Muslims and Christians respect each other's beliefs. Now, religious leaders are taking things a step further by working together to eradicate Ebola. In mosques and churches, the leaders are taking examples from the Bible and Quran to teach people about Ebola prevention. The idea came from a local organization called Focus 1000. It recognized the importance of working with well-respected and trusted faith leaders. Reverend Christiana Sutton Karoma says people were reluctant to accept the importance of Ebola quarantine until it was explained in church.
But that is one key thing also the scripture tells us in Leviticus 13, that when somebody is infected with an infectious skin disease, that individual or that community should be quarantined.
It's important for anyone associated with Ebola to be quarantined as the virus is spread through direct contact with bodily fluids. When Reverend Karoma explained this from the Bible and how it relates to Ebola, people started to listen. The religious references are helping raise awareness, says Lamaratu Kamara, who attends the church.
I've seen it in my own community. I've seen it a lot in my own community. And now, thanks be to God that we're all taking the precaution.
Dr. Ramadan Jallo is an imam in Freetown and is taking examples from the Quran to preach about Ebola in the mosque.
Islam has warned against anything that will endanger the life of an individual. So if you're going to wash this body, touch this body, and that's going to cause, lead you into problem, then Islam is warning against such an act.
Aid agency World Vision is doing similar work with faith leaders across the country. World Vision National Director Leslie Scott says it's because of the religious tolerance the leaders have been able to work so well together. Ebola has killed more than 3,000 people in Sierra Leone since the virus spread here almost a year ago. Nina DeVries for VOA News, Freetown, Sierra Leone.
Earlier this year, several feminists in China were arrested just before an international day celebrating women's equality. They were some of the most visible activists in China and mostly tolerated by China's authoritarian government. Until now, Shannon Van Zandt reports on China's women's rights movement from Hong Kong.
They were called the Feminist Five and China's most prominent women's rights activists when police detained them ahead of International Women's Day in March for picking quarrels and provoking trouble. The women's arrest drew international condemnation. Former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Samantha Power, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, tweeted messages of support. Police released the women on the eve of their 37th day in prison, when they would have been required by law to formally charge them. But the activist detentions have left many within the women's rights community with questions. Iron, who prefers to go by a pseudonym, has worked with the Feminist Five on women's issues in China.
Because we all know that what we are doing is right, is trying to make people's life better. Like, why they got arrested? Just because they try to promote anti-sexual harassment.
The detained women were Li Tingting, Zhang Churan, Wei Tingting, Wu Rongrong, and Wang Man. They had planned to launch a campaign against sexual harassment on public transportation on International Women's Day, handing out stickers and pamphlets on buses and trains. It was not the first public event they had organized on behalf of women's rights. In 2012, they occupied men's public toilets to demand equal facilities for women. Some of them also previously launched a bloodstained bride campaign, during which they posed in red-stained wedding dresses to draw attention to domestic violence. The Feminist Five occupy a new, very vocal chapter in China's women's rights movement. Culturally, women were supposed to be submissive and obedient to men and not allowed to participate in government. Under Mao Zedong, women achieved greater equality. China outlawed bound feet, and propaganda heroes included women like the Iron Girls of Shanxi Province, who built terraced farmland. Li Xiaojiang's 1983 essay, Progress of Mankind and Women's Liberation, was the first women's studies publication after China became more open. Today's feminists in China are young. Most are only 25 or 26 years old and say their public campaigns began only a couple of years ago. Zhang Jin Yan is a Chinese blogger and rights activist.
Over the past decades, two decades, this generation of one-child policy, these girls, they received a high education and they are able to speak for their interest. That's why you can see the more controversies.
The women's rights activists say their arrests earlier this year have only inspired them and galvanized others to join their cause. Maya Wong of Human Rights Watch says they are fighting a long-term battle.
So it's not quite easy to put kind of the genie back into the bottle. We will see probably a temporary kind of lowering level of activity, a scaling back. But in the long run, these problems are still going to be there, and I think that women's rights movement will continue to grow.
Even after their release, the women remain under investigation for charges of disturbing public order and picking quarrels and provoking trouble. The women's lawyers say they are still considered suspects by the Chinese government, and some have continued to be subject to several hour-long police interrogations. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Hong Kong.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Linor Mudu. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Well over 100,000 people have fled Burundi in recent weeks to escape political violence. The European Union has approved a naval operation to pursue human traffickers on the Mediterranean and stem the increasing flow of migrants from Africa and the Middle East. And UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon warns the conflict in Yemen could lead to a destabilization of East Africa. Coming up, we'll have music from Malawi, and in our feature segment, doctors from India perform free surgeries in Zimbabwe's third largest city of Mutare. I'm Kim Lewis with Nyeyas Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are kicking off today with Ghana football.
Kim, some good news and bad news for two of Ghana's top football players. Bad news first. The Court of Arbitration for Sport has upheld a four-month ban for defender Jonathan Mensah following his transfer from the Italian club Udinese. Udinese claimed Mensah's transfer to the French side Evian in 2011 was illegal because he was still under contract with the Italian club, despite claiming to be a free agent. Mensah's four-month ban began on April 30th. According to World Football's governing body, FIFA, the 24-year-old defender will serve the final 3 months of the ban from the official start of the next French League season. FIFA says Mensah can play for Ghana in World Cup qualifying matches and any other games that are not a final competition of an international tournament. That means Jonathan Mensah will be able to play in Ghana's 2017 Africa Cup of Nations qualifying match against Mauritius, currently scheduled for June 14th in the capital, Accra. On a happier note, Ghana and Marseille midfielder Andre Dede Ayew has been named the top African player in France's Ligue 1. The 25-year-old Ayew is one of the sons of Ghanaian great Abedi Pele, who also played for Marseille. Ayew scored 10 goals in 27 appearances for Marseille this season. He received the Marc Vivien Foe Trophy, named after the former Cameroonian midfielder who also played in the French League and who died suddenly in 2003 during a FIFA Confederations Cup match. Andre Ayew has said he's planning to leave Marseille after this season, and he's attracted interest from several English Premier League clubs.
Voice of America!
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the sunny side of sports on the Voice of America. Athletic South Africa held an invitational meet over the weekend at the Germiston Stadium, just east of Johannesburg. Our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma, went to the stadium and had a chance to talk with a top hurdler and the African champion in the men's long jump. Here's Mark.
African long jump champion Zach Fiser of South Africa leaped to a distance of 8.18 meters, thus qualifying for the World Athletics Championships due in Beijing, China in August. He's all fired up for the season. Fiser explains why he has only just started competing this year.
Yeah, I think last week was just my initial comeback. It was my first meeting after my operation I had in January. I planned and prepared for this meeting like a week later, and now I've qualified. I think I just came here to qualify for the World Championships, and that's what I did today.
Tell us a little about this injury. What exactly happened?
I got injured last year, April, slight injury. We just had to manage it through the season. I had to go for a scan. After the scan, they realized there was actually something wrong with me, and then we fixed it in Jan. There was sketch about the comeback. It was going to take 6 months, and now I'm back in four. So everything went amazingly, thanks God for everything he's done for me, so I'm happy.
So going forward, you've qualified for the World Championships. What are your plans, or do you want to take it easy this year because of the injury?
No, there's no taking it easy. Work is work. I think I'm ready for work now. I've been on leave for a long time, so now I'm ready to take these boys on, on the field. Basically, I'm 100% now. No taking it easy. Going for world medal. First need to get to that final. Everything I'm doing now is in preparation for that championship.
Your personal best?
8.32, but we need to break that this year.
That was South Africa's Zach Fiser, the Africa long jump champion, speaking in Ekurhuleni. Meanwhile, South Africa's 2011 Africa Junior Championship 110-meter hurdles silver medalist Tsepo Lefete improved his personal best to 13.57 seconds. He has mixed feelings about his achievement.
I'm pretty happy with the PB. I'll take it any day, but I wasn't really happy with my execution of the race. I kind of stumbled midway, but I was surprised with the way I caught up with Antonio, and I was able to run him down. But like I said, PB, I'll take it any day, and I'm happy with the PB.
Two PBs back to back in a week. What does that say going forward?
I need more racing. I need more tough competition. I'm progressing. I'm only getting better. So yeah, let's get more races and see if I can qualify for World Champs.
That was South Africa's Tsepo Lefete, the former Africa Junior Championship 110-meter hurdle silver medalist, speaking in Ekurhuleni. Kenyan Stephen Sambu clocked a lifetime best of 27 minutes and 30 seconds to win the Great Manchester 10-kilometer run in Britain on Sunday. South African Stephen Mokoka was runner-up in a career best time of 27 minutes and 38 seconds. Mokoka also betters the South Africa 10-kilometer record from 27 minutes and 50 seconds held by Shadrack Hoff since 2002. Kenyan Bernard Lagat was third in 27 minutes and 48 seconds. The trio are the world's fastest runners in 10 kilometers this year. Meanwhile, Kenyan Betsy Saina won the women's race in 31 minutes and 49 seconds. Britain's Gemma Steele was 6 seconds behind, while Kenyan Edna Kiplagat was third in 31 minutes and 57 seconds. Finally, in cycling, 22-year-old James Reid led Matthew Bilkes, Rookie Crossier, Brendan Davis and Philip Byers in a 1-2-3-4-5 South African sweep at the Africa Mountain Bike Continental Championships in Musanze, Rwanda on Sunday. Mauritius is second and Rwanda third. The contest is a qualifier for the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics.
G'day, mates. Remember me? This is the old sports emperor with a red-hot listening tip. That's right. Give a listen to my pal, the bright and lively Sunny Man on the sunny side of sports, right here on the Voice of America.
This is Larry Zamude, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 80.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja, Nigeria. Let's talk to you about Brilla FM. It's Nigeria's only sports station. Of course, we partner at UA. VOA. And so you can listen to Sunny Side of Sports on 80.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja. Keep listening, Africa, and enjoy Sunny Side of Sports on Brilla.
Thanks, Dr. Larry. In addition to Lagos and Abuja, Dr. Larry has sports radio 88.9 Brilla FM stations in Kaduna and Onitsha, Nigeria. More grease to the sporty elbows of you and your staff, Dr. Larry.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
I encourage our VOA listeners with internet access to check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. The address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. Once again, that address, facebook.com/VOA Sunny. You'll see photos and videos, and you can post your comments. So check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page.
Voice of America!
And if you check out my Facebook page today, Tuesday, you'll see a photo of two of basketball's best shooting guards, James Harden of the Houston Rockets and Stephen Curry of the Golden State Warriors. Harden and Curry are front and center in the NBA's Western Conference Finals, which tip off later Tuesday night in Oakland, California. The marquee matchup features league most valuable player Curry and the runner-up Harden, who led the NBA in points scored this season. Curry and the Warriors dominated during the regular season, winning 67 games. In the second round of the playoffs, Golden State fell behind the Memphis Grizzlies 2-1, but Curry's prolific three-point shooting fueled a win in each of the next three games. James Harden and the Rockets, meanwhile, had a tougher road to the conference finals. Houston is just the ninth team in NBA history to overcome a 3-1 deficit and win a 7-game series. And their 19-point comeback win against the Los Angeles Clippers in Game 6 of the conference semifinals is regarded as the most stunning victory of the 2015 NBA playoffs. If we take a look at the regular season matchups between the teams, well, the Warriors have to be considered the favorite. They won all 4 games between the clubs. One big difference maker for Houston, though, is a healthy Dwight Howard at center. Howard missed 2 of the regular season games between the teams because of injury. The NBA's Eastern Conference Finals will tip off on Wednesday night in Atlanta, Georgia. The Atlanta Hawks will host LeBron James and the Cleveland Cavaliers in Game 1 of another best-of-7 game series. The Cavs received some good news ahead of the first game. Star guard Kyrie Irving, who has been bothered by a sore right foot, says he'll definitely play in the opener. The winners of the 2 series will advance to the NBA Finals, which begin June 4th. In other NBA news, 4-time All-Star LaMarcus Aldridge of the Portland Trailblazers had surgery to repair a ligament in his left thumb. The Blazers say Aldridge is expected to return to basketball activity in about 8 weeks. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, doctors from India performing free surgeries in Zimbabwe's third largest city of Mutare. And next, efforts to better equip medical facilities and improve the training of healthcare workers in South Sudan. But for some music, here is Alan Nguma, Ya of Malawi, with Jabulani. Thank you. Allen and Gumuya of Malawi with Jabulani.
Well, 19 doctors from India have been performing free surgeries in Zimbabwe's third largest city of Mutare, thanks to Rotary International. Since arriving on May 3rd, the surgeons have treated more than 1,000 patients, various areas including orthopedic, optometry, and gynecology. Reporter Laura Moyo has more.
The program known as the Rotary Medicare Project Vocational Training Team to Zimbabwe is the brainchild of the Rotary International and the Rotary Foundation. It started 2 weeks ago at Mutare Provincial Hospital, Nyanga District Hospital, and Sakova District Hospital's eye unit. Surgeries were conducted in various fields, including orthopedics, gynecology, optometry, and others. Manikalani Provincial Medical Director Dr. Patron Vengema Faune says the specialist doctors successfully carried out 1,100 individual surgeries after setting a target of 800. She says the specialist doctors were working in 5 medical categories in the 3 referral hospitals where patients were screened before undergoing the necessary operations.
For Nyanga District, they actually organized a weekend where they went out with doctors, I think that had been supported by the Honorable Minister, Superman Dwanzira, and they went and they screened in their facilities. And then for the province, for the other districts in Manicaland, we worked with our Provincial Minister of State and also the Provincial Administrator, who then used our local leaders, like the councillors and the chiefs, to mobilize for our communities to go to the nearest district hospital for screening.
Dr. Mafaune says the free medical service was a timely intervention as most people were not in a position to pay for such surgeries due to financial hardships. She says local hospitals are currently facing shortages of medical doctors among related staff members. One of the beneficiaries, Love Modzina Marira, was involved in a motorcycle accident. His injured leg was supposed to be amputated, but this was addressed by the visiting doctors.
I am very grateful for the assistance. My leg is now fine.
Dr. Rajan Sharma, who operated on Tsinamatira's leg, says he is lucky to have had the operation in time and with the right care, since he was going to be an amputee or become handicapped.
He has sustained the fracture for 2 weeks back, and it was not operated. And it was only given a conservative treatment only in the form of traction, which he should have a deformity and physical disability of 2-inch shortening. His lower limb should have been 2-inch short. Now we operated him. Now he is absolutely okay now.
Another beneficiary of the free medical service is Fungwa Chakandinakira. The man says he did not have money for an operation that he needed until he was helped by these doctors.
I am happy with the free treatment I have received from these doctors. Since I did not have the money for the surgery, I am really happy.
Gynecologist Dr. Manisha Jekteb says the team carried out surgeries on a large number of women with fibroids.
Fibroid patient She was nulliparous, having no children and having three big fibroids. So we have removed only the fibroids. The uterus is saved. And the operation is now just done. Now there is an emergency cesarean section. And after that, again, more four patients we are supposed to operate.
Project advisor and pathologist Dr. Rajiv Pradhan notes that the 19-member team was in Zimbabwe as a gesture of extending a helping hand to less privileged people in Africa. He says they have also been to Malawi, Swaziland, and Rwanda, among other African nations.
Why did we come to Butare? This is a part of our own initiative through Rotary International. We are from India, and way back in 1998, after I had finished my world presidency and everything, we started thinking that we must also realize in action that humanity is one throughout the world. And we wanted to do service beyond borders.
The free medical treatment has been timely to most Zimbabweans hard-pressed to raise money for medical fees. Reporting in Mutare, this is Leda Moyo.
In South Sudan, reproductive health specialists and national health officials recently celebrated International Day of the Midwife in Juba. They used the occasion to send a message that nurses and midwives are overstretched and not able to provide quality care to patients across the country. They're calling on the government and its health partners to better equip medical facilities and improve the training of health workers. For VOA News, Lucy Pony reports.
The president of the South Sudan Nurses and Midwives Association, Sake Jemelia, says nurses and midwives work in horrible conditions and face enormous challenges. In fact, she says, nurses and midwives represent 75% to 80% of all healthcare workers in the country, and when they are poorly trained or lack access to the equipment they need, they cannot improve maternal health or provide quality healthcare, two of the Millennium Development Goals. South Sudan's health ministry says there are about 700 registered nurses and midwives in a country of about 12 million people. Jemelia says nurses and midwives are overworked and underpaid.
Surely, the salary that we are getting, it's now in the black market when we compare the rate of dollars. It's like we are working with the $100, $150, which is very, very little. And this person needs to sponsor children in school. They will not be able to do that. So we are really advocating, let our employers look at it and improve our salary.
Lucia Thomas, the matron at Juba Teaching Hospital, the main referral hospital in the country, says most nurses also face language challenges. She says the majority of them, including herself, studied in Arabic and find it difficult to communicate in English, the official language of South Sudan. She encourages nurses to work on improving their English skills so they can understand doctors' instructions. And she says, although many nurses, midwives and traditional birth attendants may not have formal schooling, they are very experienced in dealing with patients and emergency situations. They are just too overwhelmed to provide quality services.
They say that our nursing care is not standard. I agree. It cannot be standard. The number of nurses working at the Juba Teaching Hospital is very little. You find two nurses caring for 60 patients. I was taught in school that one nurse should care for four stable patients, but unstable patients need four nurses each. What is happening here is not nursing.
According to Save the Children's 16th Annual State of the World's Mothers Report, in South Sudan, a girl is more likely to die during childbirth than complete her primary education. The director of nursing and midwifery at the Ministry of Health, Janet Michael, says over 70% of South Sudan's population is under the age of 30, which means most women are in their reproductive years. She says the government must invest in training midwives across the country to reduce high infant and maternal mortality rates.
This demands for more midwives to be trained and placed in every part of the country so that the services is accessible. In order for midwives to do their job effectively, facilities need to be appropriately staffed and stocked with the necessary equipment and supplies to offer appropriate services, including emergencies. Therefore, as the overarching theme goes, South Sudan needs more midwives now than ever.
The Health Ministry, in conjunction with its international health partners, is conducting training sessions at the Juba College of Nursing and Midwifery, as well as the Central Equatoria School of Nursing and Midwifery. But Michael says more must be done. She says many trained nurses end up employed in the private sector. Michael says the government should be hiring them. Michael vows that the Ministry of Health will do its best to improve conditions for nurses and midwives who provide the bulk of health care to communities across the country. For VOA News, I'm Lucy Pony in Juba.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Zubair Tayeb, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States continues to find new ways to support global entrepreneurship. At a time when the world is more interconnected than ever, said President Barack Obama, we've got unprecedented opportunities to help more people access capital and resources and networks that they need to succeed. Youth around the world are particularly in need of greater opportunities. More than half the world's population is under the age of 30, and in some countries, youth unemployment can exceed 35%. When so many young people don't see a future for themselves, it holds an entire nation back. That's why the United States seeks to train and empower thousands of aspiring entrepreneurs. As part of its Young African Leaders Initiative, the U.S. offers training and grants and online resources and courses and leadership centers to help young entrepreneurs build businesses in Africa. In Southeast Asia, the U.S. has connected young people across the ASEAN countries through the Young Southeast Asian Leaders Initiative. The U.S. has also launched an initiative for young entrepreneurs in the Caribbean and Latin America. All told, the U.S. has set a goal of generating $1 billion in new investment for emerging entrepreneurs worldwide by 2017. Half of this money will go to support young entrepreneurs and women entrepreneurs. The program, known as the Spark Global Entrepreneurship Initiative, will bring together some of the most successful entrepreneurship programs across the government and make sure that they're working with the private sector in ways that allow for long-term sustained success. Some of America's most successful business leaders and innovators are joining this effort. One of those is Julie Hanna, who will use her expertise leading Kiva to increase access to capital around the world. Her project commits to delivering $100 million in crowdfunded loans to 200,000 women and young entrepreneurs across 86 different countries. With the Spark Global Entrepreneurship Initiative, said President Obama, we can make sure that anyone who's got the creativity and drive to work hard, no matter where they're from, what they look like, what their background is, they get a fair shot at pursuing their dreams. And we'll all be better for it.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, I'm Lino Moudou.
Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals